K-Mud Podcast presents.
Hey! Wamikara Yahweh, Wariko Wakia Tainoki. Bon Matu Usika Wakia, para Yukia, Ajika Sabi, Urakanwa, Yukiu Han, Diosanaboridaka.
Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. I opened with a Brulé, Buffalo Moon from their great CD, We the People. And if you just heard Making Contact and you heard all about these, you know, Native mental health programs, know that that's one of the programs. They're going to be axed with Trump's big budget he wants to do to support all his wars. And he's going to cut back on, you know, everything that's already been cut back on, but mainly so many Native programs, mental health programs, loan programs, education programs, and things that are guaranteed in so many of the treaties that were signed. And he's just ignoring that. And it was so beautiful to hear that program and to know, you know, what was created and what they're doing to help the indigenous people, and yet the funding for it, just like the funding for KEMA, you know, taken away by this crazy maniac person that thinks, you know, he's president of the United States. I mean, when you have children that are an Easter egg hunt and he sits down with them, yeah, you know, they had their Easter egg hunt on the front lawn of the White House. And he starts talking to him about how Biden didn't know how to use an auto pen and starts talking about war with little kids that just came to get Easter eggs. You know, I don't even know if the 25th Amendment is good enough to get rid of him. But anyway, I just had to say that when I heard, you know, because I know, you know, the programs that are being cut and it's hurting all people of every color. And... Another thing that he's doing, and it was in the Supreme Court last Wednesday, and I have two stories I want to share about, because the Trump team cites an 1884 Native American Supreme Court case in his birthright citizenship fight. On the first day of his second term, President Donald Trump signed an executive order seeking to end birthright citizenship, the longstanding policy granting U.S. citizenship to nearly anyone born in the country. The order specified that children would not automatically receive citizenship if their parents were in the United States unlawfully or in the country temporarily on visas. Lower federal courts struck down the order as unconstitutional, prompting the Supreme Court of the United States to take up the case. Well, last Wednesday, the court heard more than 2 hours of oral arguments in Trump versus Barbara. Trump attended the opening of the arguments, becoming the first sitting U.S. president to appear at a Supreme Court hearing before departing shortly afterwards. And, it's, you know, he's never done that before. Well, when I heard that, everyone goes, that's weird. No, it's called intimidation. He went and sat right there in front of the Supreme Court. This is me. You're gonna go the way I want it. Look at me. That's what that was about. But to continue... At the center of the dispute is the 14th Amendment, which guarantees citizenship to anyone born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction of the country. For more than a century, the language has been understood to confer automatic citizenship regardless of a child's parentage. The Trump administration, however, has urged a narrower interpretation, one that excludes certain children born to non-citizens. To support its position, the administration pointed to Elk versus Wilkins, an 1884 decision involving John Elk, a member of the Omaha tribe who was denied the right to vote. After leaving his tribal community in Nebraska and living among non-Native residents in Omaha, Elk attempted to register to vote in 1880. The local register, Wilkins, refused, arguing Elk was not a U.S. citizen. At the time, Native Americans were generally not recognized as citizens unless naturalized or specifically granted that status under federal law. Yeah, trust me, it wasn't until 1924 that they decided Native Americans were citizens. But to continue, Elk sued, claiming that the 14th Amendment made him a citizen because he was born in the United States and had subjected himself to U.S. law. The case ultimately became a test of whether Native Americans who left their tribes could unilaterally claim citizenship. The Supreme court ruled against him, holding that Elk was not automatically a citizen because he was born into a tribal nation, which the court viewed as a separate political community. The decision resurfaced in Wednesday's argument as the Trump administration sought to use it to define the limits of birthright citizenship, but critics argue that the case had been misapplied. Quote, "We believe the reliance on Elk to deny birthright citizenship to children of undocumented immigrants is misplaced. It's a misreading and a misunderstanding," said Lenny Findeay, general counsel for the National Congress of the American Indian. The Elk decision, he said, rests solely on the unique status of, quote, Kwanzaa sovereign tribal government and is limited to that context. During arguments, an attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union directly addressed Elk, seeking to narrow its relevance. The attorney emphasized that the case arose from a distinct legal framework involving tribal sovereignty, arguing that Elk's circumstances are fundamentally different from those of children born in the United States to non-citizen parents today. At the time, Native nations were treated as separate political communities, meaning Elk was not considered fully subject to U.S. jurisdiction in the same way others born on U.S. soil were. The attorney contrasted that history with modern immigration law, noting that non-citizens, regardless of status, are fully subject to U.S. authority. In doing so, the argument reframed Elk versus Wilkins as a narrow exception, not a broad limitation on birthright citizenship. The focus then shifted to United States versus Wong Kim Ark, which the ACLU argued in its controlling precedent. That decision, they said, firmly established that children born in the United States are citizens regardless of their parents' nationality, creating a fixed bright line rule under the 14th Amendment. I have to say here, you know, both my parents came from Ecuador. They became naturalized citizens, but What does that make me, you know, according to all of this? But to continue, after the oral arguments ended on Wednesday, legal experts said the Trump administration's case to birthright citizenship appeared to face skepticism. It remains unclear whether the justices were fully convinced by the administration's position. A final decision in the case is expected by summer of 2026. And that came from Native News Online. And this is from Julie Francella. And she says, "I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not a lawyer of any kind. I don't quote Latin. Heck, I still lose my reading glasses while they're sitting on my head. But I am Native, and I know what it feels like when governments reach into our history, pull something out of context, and try to make it do ugly new work." On Wednesday, April 1st, the U.S. Supreme Court heard Trump versus Barbara, the case over Donald Trump's executive order attacking birthright citizenship. Solicitor General John Saar argued for the administration. Cecilia Wang argued for the challengers. Everybody keeps trying to present this as some technical fight over wording, some sterile little constitutional housekeeping problem. It's not. It is a fight over who gets to belong on this land. And as a Native person, I cannot help noticing the arrogance of descendants of European invaders still appointing themselves the final authority over belonging, legality, and who gets to stay on land that was never theirs to begin with. And Native history was dragged into that courtroom. Well, the loophole they are hunting for, well, the administration's argument leans on Elk versus Wilkins from 1884, the case where the court held that John Elk, a Native man born on U.S. soil, was not automatically a U.S. citizen under the 14th Amendment. The thing is, Elk versus Wilkins was never an immigration case. It came out of the distinct political status of tribal nations, which the federal government treated as sovereign communities with their own legal relationship to the United States. That is the first thing people need to understand. Native exclusion from citizenship was never some broad model for how to deny citizenship to whoever the government decides is suspicious this week. It was rooted in sovereignty, in the fact that tribes pre-existed in the United States and were treated as potentially, as politically distinct, even while the federal government constantly tried to constrain, manage, and absorb that distinction. Congress did not broadly extend U.S. citizenship to Native American people until the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, and even then it did not erase tribal citizenship or tribal nationhood. What the administration is doing is taking a piece of Native legal history shaped by sovereignty and trying to recycle it into a rule for immigrants and their children. They are reaching into one of the ugliest chapters of citizenship law and trying to reuse it for modern nativism. They are hunting for an old exclusion they can force into new service. But Native people were not excluded because we somehow did not belong to this land. We were excluded because the United States had to contend with the fact that tribal nations already existed, already governed, already had political identity before America ever got around to deciding who counted. That's the whole point. And once you strip that away, once you sand down the sovereignty and erase the actual reason elk existed, you are no longer interpreting history. You are laundering it. And you could hear the weakness in that argument in open court. Justice Neil Gorsuch asked Sauter a simple question under the government's theory. Would Native Americans be citizens? Sauter's answer was not a clean, confident yes. It was, I think so. That hesitation says plenty. Because the example the government is using to narrow citizenship does not even sit comfortably inside its own theory. When Native people become the test case and the answer suddenly gets fuzzy, that tells you something. It tells you this is not careful constitutional interpretation. It's a legal scavenger hunt for anything that can be used to exclude the people they don't want here. Cecilia Wang made an important point in court. Elk versus Wilkins, she argued, has no bearing on the question of foreign nationals. The governing precedent is still United States versus Wong Kim Ark of 1898, where the court held that a child born on U.S. soil was a citizen, even though his parents were not U.S. citizens. That has been settled law for well over a century. So what's happening here is not clarification. It's an attempt at revision. Take something specific, strip off the context, repackage the injury. Use it to narrow rights for people who were never the subject of that doctrine in the first place. The executive order itself is written to apply to people born after its effective date. So no, it does not directly announce that it is stripping current citizens of citizenship. But the theory underneath it is bigger than that, much bigger. Because once you start arguing that citizenship depends not simply on birth here, but on some documented form of state-approved allegiance or jurisdictional consent, you are destabilizing the very foundation birthright citizen rests on. And if that logic were ever applied evenly, not just weaponized against the families this administration wants to target, mostly brown and black families, then the ground starts shifting under a whole lot of other people too, including white Americans. Because generations of European immigrants did not arrive carrying some neat little folder of formally documented allegiance that settled the matter forever. Their descendants are treated as unquestionably American because the country chose over time to treat them that way, because whiteness gets absorbed, because belonging gets softened and smoothed out for some people, while for others it becomes a maze, a trap door, a test they are expected to keep taking. This is part of what makes this so dangerously and so revealing. By trying to screw over the so-called other, they are tugging at a legal structure that was never as tidy or as neutral as people pretend. Pull apart enough on the citizenship of the people you want to cast out, and eventually you start yanking at the whole house of cards. These arguments are always enforced selectively. That's the point. They want the loophole. They want a theory that makes some children vulnerable while leaving others untouched, and they are reaching into Native history to build it. Native people know this pattern. Our history gets flattened and repurposed by people who don't care what it means. They just care about what they can use it for. A case shaped by indigenous sovereignty is now being used to narrow someone else's rights. Nope, you don't get to use our history this way. Not this time, not while we're still here.
It began like a bright sunny day, benign and full of promises, they say. In strange crafts called ships they arrived, lost, sick and starving, just barely. Pitied by the old ones, the strange ones from the east. We're taught to know survival and we're guests at the feast. Then like dark clouds, the strange ones spread their wings. A paradise they claim for more strange ones they would. Voices in the wind about the strange things that were done, like cutting mother into pieces for their sons, and how blood flowed from the children's sacred hair. Angry words of war were spoken. Holocaust, 100 million lives were lost. Tears must be shed, then healing will begin. Will begin. Will begin.
Two Eagle, American Holocaust, from his great CD, In America. Well, I'm going to share some stories with you because I don't know if you're aware, but, you know, 47 has, you know, he wants to have, if he could get away with the U.S. Forestry Service, he would. But what he's doing, he's taking the headquarters, closing the headquarters in Washington, D.C., and making Salt Lake City the headquarters. Because Salt Lake City and all the Utah, you know, senators and all their politicians, they all believe that the public land should not be public land, that they, any, you know, any extraction that any kind of big corporation wants to extract should be able to do that. And he's closing down 67 of the U.S. Forestry Service's office. I believe only like 27 are going to be left. And, you know, making the, it used to be like a 90-day period. Now it's like 7 days. People don't even know. I mean, and he's just, what's happening to so many areas, and especially, you know, near reservations or on reservations on sacred land, they're doing everything they can to get control, and like they did with Oak Flat. And I'm just, you know, the fact that Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan wouldn't even take it up again is mind-blowing. But let me tell you, the Apache people, they're not giving up. They're not giving up. That's their sacred land. That holds very special to them. So I have a handful of stories of some of the things they're doing, because New Mexico's federal delegation and tribal officials on April 1st accused the Trump administration of rushing the process to reverse a federal ban on oil and gas drilling around Chaco Cultural Historical National Historical Park by only allowing a week for limited public comment. The Trump administration for the last year has floated a proposal to reverse a Biden-era order that issued a 20-year ban on oil and gas development on federal lands within 10 miles of the site, which holds paramount spiritual and cultural significance for numerous tribes and pueblos. And, I mean, you just look at the aerial views and you see, you know, all these, you know, they're like homes that were carved out in the hill. And it's all, I mean, it's just an incredible place. If you ever have a chance to see it before they think they can destroy it, I mean, it's just, you know, it takes you back in time. But to continue, on March 30th, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management posted an announcement seeking online public comment on the proposed reversal during a 7-day, quote, scoping period for an environmental review. The public comment period concludes on April 7th. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Couple of days ago, yesterday, meaning it occurred during the Easter, Passover, and several traditional holidays for the Pueblos. All five members of New Mexico's all-Democratic congressional delegation who reintroduced legislation last April to protect Chaco Canyon on Wednesday released statements criticizing the effects to reverse the protections and the shortened comment period. Quote, Chaco Canyon is a living cultural landscape that holds deep historical meaning and is a sacred place for many of our New Mexico tribes, U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich, who serves as ranking member of the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, said in a statement. Quote, it's not just one more place to drill. The disrespect shown by the Trump administration toward New Mexicans seems to know no bounds. U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan said it was, quote, inadequate and disgraceful to allow 7 days of public comment, quote, on the fate of a thousand-year-old sacred site. New Mexico Land Commissioner Stephanie Garcia Richard, who issued in 2023 a 20-year ban of oil and gas activity on more than 72,000 acres of state trust land within 10 miles of Chaco, also called the Trump administration's plan to reopen oil and gas development in the area, quote, a disastrous plan, and urged more for adequate public comment. Quote, giving only 7 days for communities to respond with no public meetings planned is a slap in the face to the people who have called this place home long before there ever was a United States government, Garcia Richard said. Acoma Pueblo Governor Richard Riley told Source New Mexico the requirements to submit public comment through an online portal also presents, quote, a substantial barrier, and called on the federal government to expand public comments to include mail or in-person comments. Quote, too many of our community members and elders have inconsistent or unreliable internet access, Riley said in a phone call. Quote, this approach basically excludes voices that should be included. The All Pueblo Council of Governors said the body, quote, was dismayed to learn of the federal effort to unwind the protections. Quote, Chaco Canyon will always be revered and respected as a sacred place by Pueblo people, Chairman Joey Sanchez of the Santa Ana Pueblo said in a statement. Quote, we will use our collective voice to continue the fight. Here's another one. The Indian Peaks Band of the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah has formally challenged federal approval of a major water development project in southern Utah, arguing plans threaten its water rights and cultural significant resource. On April 1st of 2026, the band, represented by the Native American Rights Fund, filed a notice of appeal and petition for stay with the Interior Board of Land Appeals, seeking review of a March 2nd decision by the Bureau of Land Management. That decision approved the Pine Valley Water Supply Project, a large-scale groundwater extraction and pipeline proposal. The filing asked the appeals board to halt the project while the case is under review. Tribal leaders contend that approval violates federal law, including the National Environmental Policy Act, and fails to protect the band's federally reserved water rights. And according to the appeal, the proposed well field lies just a few miles from the band's former reservation, ancestral lands that remain central to its cultural and historical identity. The band argues that the volume of groundwater the project developer, the Cedar Valley Water Conservancy, intends to extract exceeds sustainable levels and could significantly harm the tribe's water resources. Quote, these water resources are fundamental to our band's history, culture, and future, said Chairwoman Tamara Borchard Slayton. Quote, federal law is clear that the band's water rights must be protected. We are asking the Interior Department to do just that. The band's claim rests on federally reserved water rights tied to its former reservation lands, rights that predate many non-native uses in the region and remain legally protected. The appeal asserts that federal officials failed to adequately consider those rights or uphold the government's trust responsibility to tribal nations before approving the project. Quote, federal agencies have both a legal and moral obligation to protect tribal water rights, said Tom Murphy. This appeal seeks to ensure that those obligations are honored for the band's water rights. filed under federal regulations governing administrative appeals of Bureau of Land Management decisions, the petition also requests an immediate stay. If granted, the stay would pause construction and prevent further project commitments while the Interior Board of Land Appeals evaluates the case. The outcome of the appeal could have broader implications for how federal agencies balance water development projects with tribal water rights across the West. And this is from the Indian Collective. The Indian Collective, Black Hills Clean Water Alliance, and Earthworks filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service for their decision in February to grant a permit for exploratory drilling in Pesla, a sacred and protected indigenous site. Quote, the U.S. Federal Service use of categorical exclusion for this project is unlawful because the project cannot be completed in less than a year, which is a requirement for a categorical exclusion, said Tracy Zeffler, general counsel for Indian Collective. Quote, the project will adversely impact the religious and cultural sites at Pesla, and such impact is an extraordinary circumstance that prohibits the insurance of a categorical exclusion under NEPA. We are asking the federal court to vacate the U.S. Forest Service's approval of the permit for this project and enjoin stop any further proceedings. Quote, we will not stand for the desecration of our sacred sites, land, and water by extractive mining companies like Pete Lyne, said Wissapan Garriott, president of Indian Collective. Quote, the laws of the United States are often rigged against us, but we are confident this categorical exclusion was unlawful. We will defend this land in the courts, but as the original people of this land, sovereignty in this matter is inherent. The United States has a duty to honor the Constitution and 1868 treaty to protect Pesla for our grandchildren and all people to enjoy its sacred beauty. In addition to its violation of the rights of the Lakota and other indigenous peoples, this proposal mining project is a unique and fragile biological and geological area, said Dr. Elias Jarding, executive director of the Black Hills Clean Water Alliance. Quote, it is in the Rapid Creek watershed and threatens water for Rapid City, Ellsworth Air Force Base, tribal communities, and ranching operations downstream along the Cheyenne River. Rapid Creek's water also fills our area's groundwater sources. It is critical that we take action to protect the surface and groundwater that make our lives and our communities possible. Pesla has been a place of ceremony for the Lakota and other indigenous peoples for thousands of years. It is a site encompassing several thousand acres, with part of the site owned by sovereign tribal nations and part of the site within the U.S. Forest Service lands. A 2024 Memorandum of Understanding between the U.S. Forest Service and representative tribal nations of the Osati Sakowin acknowledged and agreed that Pesla was one of great cultural and religious importance to them, and the 2014 MOU created a two-mile buffer zone around Pesla, and the U.S. Forest Service made a commitment to protect that area. And despite that, on Friday, February 27th of 2026, the U.S. Forest Service issued a permit to Pete Lynn and Sons, an extractive mining company, to conduct exploratory drilling for graphite on federal lands adjacent to tribal lands where indigenous people continue to pray and conduct cultural activities. The closest borehole is less than 1/2 mile from the legal boundary of Pesla. The drilling permit was deemed by the U.S. Forest Service to be eligible for a, quote, categorical exclusion, meaning the project will be exempt from a more in-depth federal environmental review process required under the National Environmental Policy Act. Indian Collective, Black Hills Water Alliance, and others have been fighting to protect Pesla for over a year. They mobilized community members to submit thousands of public comments last spring, testified against the project at hearings and information gathering meetings, collected over 6,000 signatures on a petition calling on the U.S. Forest Service to rescind the permit to Peter Lynn and Sons, and educated audiences about the importance of this sacred site through the Land Back for the People podcast, social media, news interviews, and more. Some Earl Bullhead from the Lakota Nation. Hey Sapape, it's a song about the Black Hills, and it came from his great CD, Keeper of the Drum. One more story, yes, is about uranium mining, because a plan to drill exploratory holes in search of uranium near a southern Black Hills canyon lined with ancient Native American rock art has raised tensions ahead of the hearing to determine the project's fate. At a procedural hearing in January, a tense exchange with project opponents led to an outburst by a member of the board considering the project's permit application. Quote, "Your goal in life is to be a jerk," board member Bob Morris told a member of the public attending the hearing. The comment was directed toward Taylor Gunhammer. He's an Oglala Lakota community organizer. Quote, "It was just profoundly unprofessional," Gunhammer said afterwards, reacting to the exchange. Gunhammer and other project opponents were arguing for the relocation of the permit hearing from the state capital city of Pierre in central South Dakota to a location closer to the proposed project in the southwestern part of the state. Morris's fellow 12 board members ultimately agreed to move the hearing to the city of Hot Springs. The hearing was scheduled to begin April 13th, but a notice issued this week says the hearing has been postponed with no further details. I'm really wondering if that hearing's ever going to happen. Yeah, they're just going to start drilling. Anyway, the hearing will be a continuation of a long-running struggle over proposed uranium mining in the southern Black Hills. Uranium is a metallic radioactive element used as fuel in nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants. Uranium mining became common in the 1950s to supply the United States with minerals for Cold War nuclear weapons. I just want to, you know, it happened wherever they dug for uranium, especially around Navajo land. I mean, the people ended with cancer and all kinds of diseases. It is just so highly poisonous. But to continue, this included the southern Black Hills of South Dakota, where mining and milling occurred in the Edgemont area until the 1970s. And much of that mining took the form of open pits, some of which were never reclaimed to a natural condition. In the early 2000s, a new proposal arose to mine uranium near the southern Black Hills map dots of Dewey and Burdock. That plan from Texas-based Encore Energy has met staunch opposition from Native Americans and environmental activists and has been in regulatory and legal limbo for two decades. The project will utilize the in situ method of drilling wells and injecting a solvent to loosen underground uranium deposits and draw them to the surface. Last year, the federal government's permitting council selected Encore's project for inclusion in FAST 41, a process intended to improve coordination among permitting agencies and hold them accountable to deadlines. Interest in uranium exploration and mining has risen recently in response to nuclear energy's potential to meet the growing electricity demands of data centers handling the computing needs of artificial intelligence. In March of 2024, yeah, that's AI, folks. You know, think about that. I always say, you know, when you click on, you know, Google and the first thing is AI, go to the next thing. AI uses, it's going to dry up all the water sources in this country. But to continue, Nexus says it has claims on a total of nearly 10 square miles of land along the southern edge of the Black Hills. Its proposed exploration project, called CORD, spans a mix of federal and state lands totaling nearly 6 square miles. The company has a lease on 1 square mile of state land in Fall River County, which is a portion of the project under consideration by the State Board of Minerals and Environment. Clear Nuclear Energy plans to use 50 drilling sites to drill holes up to 700 feet deep on state land, according to its 2024 application. Each hole will take approximately 2 weeks to drill. It's estimated that the operation will use up to 10,000 gallons of water daily, drawing from nearby municipal and private water sources to help lubricate drills. I hope you're understanding what's going on here. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. The citizens of Fall River County, where much of the historical... a part of the court, the federal agency has fielded nearly 1,000 public comments about the project, including opposition from 6 tribal nations. And the citizens of Fall River County, where much of this historical mining took place and new mining is proposed, voted in 2022 to declare mining for uranium a public nuisance. But Clean Nuclear Energy attorneys argue that state law supersedes county ordinances, and the Minerals and Environmental Board agreed. Morris, appointed by the board to rule on motions, said the decision hinged on the difference in South Dakota's, quote, legal definitions of a mining operation and a, quote, uranium exploration operation, which constitute separate actions. Oh, geez. Okay. More than 40 people and organizations have formally raised concerns about the drilling on state land. The area holds cultural and religious significance to indigenous people, for whom the Black Hills is a sacred site in their spiritual traditions. The drilling sites are near Craven Canyon, which is home to ancient rock art, including petroglyphs and pictographs. Some of the rock art is thought to be about 7,000 years old, according to the Indian Collective, an indigenous rights organization based in Rapid City. The canyon itself has been there for generations immemorial, said Dwayne Two Bulls, a lead organizer with Black Hills Clean Water Alliance. Quote, "It predates our people," Two Bulls said. Quote, "It was one of the first spots that, in our creation stories and in our history, it was always there." Some of the rock art depicts ceremonies and creation stories, Two Bulls said. Can you imagine? They're going to get rid of all that for uranium to make nuclear weapons and nuclear power so you can have AI and we can just, you know, get rid of a civilization overnight. Isn't that what Trump said? Yeah. The main concern that would come to my mind right away is that whatever they start drilling, like on top of the canyon, then it's going to affect the soundscape and it's going to cause like an internal vibration where that drilling may possibly cause the pictographs on the canyon, the petroglyphs, to pretty much shale off the canyons. Gunhammer said that the drilling proposal is an affront to indigenous people. Quote, "You would never drill for uranium in the lawn of the White House," Gunhammer said. "You would never mine for lithium at Arlington National Cemetery." A report from the State Historic Preservation Office found that vibratory effects from drilling will be minimal and that, quote, "the risk of damage to these sites is low." Other opponents worry that further drilling in the area could disrupt holes left from past exploration projects, leaving underground water deposits known as aquifers vulnerable to possible contamination. Lilas Jarling is executive director of the Black Hills Clean Water Alliance. Quote, "It's a multifaceted set of problems," she said. "All the things that drive our economy, our health, our ability to have communities here because we need water, are all things that are being impacted by the mining rush. The drilling will take place in Fall River County, the 10th most impoverished county in the state, according to the National Institute of Minority Health and Disparities. It neighbors the Pine Ridge Reservation, Oglala Lakota County, the state's most impoverished county." Quote, "We are the people who live downstreams," said Masha Shanaposhe Camp from Porcupine, South Dakota. Quote, whenever the water is affected, anything downstream, we're going to be the ones to drink this water. Native Americans also have treaty claims to the area. All of western South Dakota was set aside as a Great Sioux Reservation by the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. This subsequently forced tribes into smaller reservations. Quote, "Every single cultural resource in that 1 square mile of the project area, the area of potential impact, belongs at least to the Sioux Nation and possibly to others who have traversed that particular sacred site." I mean, this is just insane. Every day, it's like we're forgetting and losing who we are as human beings on this earth. We just cannot let this insanity continue, especially to Mother Earth. We have to keep everything in balance. And we do that by understanding all the ugliness going on, but keep it in balance by remembering to smile and be thankful for what we do have and to enjoy what comes around. I'll be back next week.
Sunrise breaks, I face the east. A brand new day, a chance to feast. Not on the pain, not on the fear, but on the wisdom I hold dear. I light the cedar, smell the smoke, the sacred promise that I spoke. To break the chain, to put down the hurt, and lift my spirit from the dirt. I'm turning the wheel now.
letting it spin and show me my way, north, south, east, and west, driving the shadows far away. The Creator holds my hand now, leading me strong and true. I'm on the red road now, walking straight and blue.
No letting the grief take hold.
I'm breaking the generational cycles old. I look to the south where the child spirit waits for the innocence and trust locked behind the heavy gates. The pain they gave my ancestors, that sorrow that ran so deep, tried to sneak into my dreaming, whispering while I sleep. But I choose the laughter, I choose the light. I'm healing what wasn't mine to fight. I'm turning the wheel now, letting it spin and show me my way, north, south, east, and west, driving the shadows far away. The Creator holds my hand now, leading me strong and true. I'm on the red road now, walking straight and ooh.
No more letting the grief take hold.
I'm breaking the generational cycles. Oh, dark comes to rest. I look at the wounds I failed to mend. I grieve the past, but I don't pretend. It's stronger than the strength that I find. Then I face the north, where the wisdom is cold and clear. I pray for the knowledge to conquer the fear. My mind is clean, my body is strong, where I belong. I'm turning the wheel now, letting it spin and show me my way, north, south, east, and west, driving the shadows far away. The Creator holds my hand now, leading me strong and true. I'm on the red road now, walking straight and new.
Letting the grief take hold.
I'm breaking the generational cycles.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.